Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Al.
So, guess what I heard the other night?
What's that?
It was an incredible podcast. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited, and it was hosted by Richard Serrett.
Really?
Yeah.
What can you tell me about it?
Well, you know, it's mind blowing. It covers mysteries and little known facts, true crime stories, just alternative history, and even the paranormal.
Sounds like they're covering everything.
They are. These guys are great. And Richard Serrett, you know, I've been on a show before. What a good interview he does.
So where do I go? Where do I find this?
Well, the best place to go is the website. It's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com.
That's what?
It's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com.
You know what? I think I'm going to go check that out. Sounds an awful lot like another show that I know of.
The Pope is a lizard, and so is the Queen, who murdered Diana and got away clean. Obama's a Kenyan, and Reagan caused AIDS. George Bush had abortions, or so people say. They knocked Norma Jean off, they killed JFK, who got shot and poisoned by the CIA. They faked the moon landing, but Roswell was real. There's drugs in the water and bugs in our meals. They can't hide the chemtrails. We can't trust vaccines. We all know that jet fuel can melt through steel beams.
Okay, every time you hear the conspiracy song, it's written by Tim Ireland, and it's part of the Campfire Songs collection. You can find it on our website. You know it's time for our conspiracy countdown, and joining us now is Dr. Joe. This is for the week of February 12th, 2018. How are you doing, Joe?
Very good. Great to be with you again, as always.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure having you. It's always good talking to you. So, you've got the conspiracies for the week.
Yeah, I have a top three, but before I got into the countdown, I've been getting a lot of emails lately from listeners asking, how do you come up with the top three? How do you know what the big three are each week? So I just wanted to take a quick minute and say how I tabulate them.
Okay.
So people don't think I'm making it up as part of some conspiracy.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So basically what I do is every night I run what's called a scrape of the internet. So I pick up everything that has a handful of search terms in it. So I'm looking for conspiracy theory, birther, truther, and then a few other terms just for fun, like Bigfoot, aliens, Loch Ness Monster, and whatnot. And what I do before I come on with you every week is I tabulate all of those scrapes and find out what the big ideas are each week. And then one thing I do is that I remove the ones that are just sort of there all the time. So, you know, if I did a very true top three each week, it would be something to do with Trump and Russia all the time.
Yeah.
and just for radio's sake, that would get a little bit boring. So I pull out some of the ones that we talk about a little bit too much to try and get to the ones that maybe people aren't hearing quite as much about but are still prominent in our internet discussions.
Excellent. It's the way we want it. And you know, and actually, I bet you I can guess one of the top three.
Well, do you want to make the guess now, or if you don't tell us till the end, then I guess you could lie and say you were right.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy. No, actually, I'm just out of the blue because I saw this, and I don't know, maybe it didn't make the top three, that the Planet X and Elon Musk, the whole thing was just fake.
Okay, well, I was leaving Planet X out just because we've talked about Planet X so many times before. But they're one of the big ones this week, and it didn't make the top three, but was Elon Musk and his car that he launched into outer space.
Yeah, was that that was just fake, right?
Well, they're saying it's real, but the reason it pops up is because the flat earthers are very upset with Elon Musk now because they're saying he's now part of the conspiracy to conceal flat Earth.
Well, there we go. I knew it. I knew he was evil.
I mean, if you see the pictures of the car driving through space, in the background you see planet Earth, and it looks round. And you know, globular. So the flat earthers, you know, have accused Elon Musk of, you know, being a part of NASA's ploy or having fallen for it.
Mm, yeah, that's what I think. Okay, well, let's get on. Number three.
So number three sort of dovetails right off of that, and that is that flat Earth. Still big in the news, and this week it's big not so much because they have a new idea or new piece of evidence, but because, again, they're failing at trying to produce evidence. Mike Hughes, who is a prominent flat earther, tried to launch himself up into outer space in a homemade rocket in order to take pictures and prove that the Earth is indeed flat. But unfortunately, and you can read this in the news, his rocket has again failed to launch. So he keeps not being able to jettison himself into space to take these pictures.
Yeah. We've asked him to be on the show, but he's shying away from media. So.
Well, I think there's an obvious question here. And one is, you know, he could probably just put an iPhone on a balloon and get the same effect without a rocket.
Oh yeah, that would work. But well, plus, how is he going to land? Like,
I guess that's another problem. Well, but assuming he's wearing a parachute, I mean,
yeah, because I would think that was a problem.
If he hasn't thought it through that far, then perhaps not being able to take off is a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, it's meant to be. Yeah, craziness.
Okay, so leaving geography behind, number two is Adele and Sam Smith are indeed the same person. And the singer Sam Smith is actually Adele in drag. Or vice versa.
Yeah, which one is it? Is she really she or he?
Like so the evidence here is pretty clear, and you could find it on Twitter. And as someone has taken recordings of Adele, slowed them down, and what you hear sounds almost exactly like Sam Smith's voice. So what they're saying is it's because of this, it's the same person.
Wow. And do we know why?
Well, I don't know if there's a clear motive, because if you're either one, you should be happy enough with just that, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just was trying to figure out why you would want to be an alter image and making money both ways. But hey.
Well, this goes back. There's a long line of thought involved here, and that is rich celebrities often do weird things, like fake their deaths, have body doubles, come back to life mysteriously, put out albums after they've been in the grave forever. So this is nothing different here. And if you remember, if our audience remembers last week, our countdown involved Tom Brady being a body double for Melania Trump. So apparently everybody is sort of in drag and shape-shifting.
Well, when in doubt, change your outfit.
Yeah.
Oh, the world. Wow. That's something to think about.
So our number one, so last week's number one focused, I think, on the Super Bowl. This week's number one focuses on our current sporting event, and that is the Winter Olympics in Korea. And the number one conspiracy theory this week, making the rounds, is that the ice has been sabotaged or cursed to make all of the skaters fall mysteriously.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, now, is that all the skaters, or is that just going to be American skaters or Korean?
Well, obviously, some American fans were upset when the American skater fell down the other evening and didn't do very well. But they've actually had an inordinate number of people falling on their jumps. And I think they've had more than five falls now. So they're saying that there's potentially something wrong with the ice.
Do you think Tonya Harding is there?
She didn't come to mind, but you know, she has been in the news lately because of I think the movie about her.
Yeah.
My thoughts immediately went to North Korea. So.
Well, yeah, of course they want it to fail.
So. That's our top three for the week. I'm sure as the Olympics carry on and more athletes have accidents, there'll probably be more conspiracy theories to explain that.
Yeah. You know, does anybody know where Hillary Clinton is?
No.
Maybe she's there.
She's competing.
Yeah. I'm going to write this one. I'm going to get this on the internet. Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, always to have you here talking about this, so thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Holy fruit salad.
Well, welcome back to the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle.
And this is Kevin Thompson, and we are coming out of WXEI, the talk of Clearview, Florida.
Okay, so here we go again. Now, today we have an extra special guest. She actually won a contest on the True Crime Case Files magazine with Judith Yates, who's the editor, who we know. And we both have written articles for that before, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, I thought you had. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, but mine didn't win.
Well, Have you read it?
Touche.
And we're welcoming another station, KXIM, from Iowa, who actually will start Monday to Fridays at, I think it's 9 in the morning. If I'm wrong, oh well. I think it's 9.
Yeah. Not quite drive time, but it is banker hours.
Yeah. Well, no, the mornings are good too. Okay. So now back to the contest winner. Now, let's find out all about it. And so, Alita Juan, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's our pleasure. So now I wanted to say, first of all, you are not like a professional writer who's been writing books and transcripts and all this stuff for years. You're actually a lawyer. So let's talk about Alita, and let's talk about how you got into writing. What led you down that road?
Okay, well, actually, my name is pronounced Alita. I know. Oh. It looks like Alita, but it's pronounced Alita. So sorry about that. But, well, I actually started writing kind of as a second career. So, I, as you said, I'm an attorney, and I practiced family law for many years. But I always loved true crime. In fact, back in high school, I used to read true crime stories. I'd lay out in a hammock out in my backyard, just reading story after story, and I always really loved it and was always enthralled by it. So I went to college, and I received a degree in criminal justice, and then I went to law school, and I actually did an internship in law school at the district attorney's office in the gang prosecution unit. And then after I graduated, I had thought I would, you know, work in the prosecutor's office. But there was 300 people that applied for 5 positions. And so, unfortunately, I didn't get in at that time. And I had just met my husband, who was well-established in San Diego, and we had gotten engaged. And I felt that I couldn't leave San Diego for, you know, to go look for a prosecutor's job somewhere else. And then I had $80,000 in student loans. So I ended up falling into family law. So I needed a job. So I had a friend who worked in family law. So I said, well, I've got to take that job. So I worked in family law for many years. And then I had a family, and I had aged parents that needed a lot of help. And they had adopted me from Bolivia when I was 2. And so, you know, I wanted to be there and help them as they had helped me. So I kind of took a break from law. But then when I came back, I said, you know what? What I had really loved was the criminal law, and I really want to get back into that. So I started shadowing with some criminal defense attorneys and other attorneys, and then I started going to these criminal court trials, and then I just started writing stories, and I would send them out and get rejections or hear nothing. And then I started a website, and I just started posting my stories and just, you know, kind of started out that way. But it's been about 5 years now, so it's, you know, it's been a work in progress, and there's been times, I have to admit, that I've been really discouraged, but, you know, you just have to keep going, I guess.
Well, just so you know, that doesn't change.
No, I know, it's the common theme. It's like trying to be an actress or actor,
yeah.
Or the writer, right?
Yeah, and yes, it doesn't matter. You have to just focus on yourself and what you're doing and what you're writing. You write from the heart or the gut, and you write for yourself. And discouragement,
right.
and the rejection will come constantly. It doesn't matter even if you've got published books. You'll still feel it. You'll still get it. You'll still be questioned. So don't let that get you down. Just focused inward and keep going, you know.
Right. I'm in a lot of different groups. I joined the Society of Professional Journalists. I've joined Sisters in Crime. I have friends that are writers, and we get together. And, you know, you hear it's the common story, I think, that it's hard to be published. You just have to just keep trying. And I love true crime. That's the thing. I have a deep passion for it. I find the cases that I go to, they're just riveting. And they move me, and I wanted not only just tell the story of what happened in the courtroom, but what lessons we can learn from it.
So is that the most important key when you're writing a story about true crime and some sort of case? Is that kind of the center of what you write about?
Yes, I'd like to write. I'd like to, of course, tell the story. What happened? Why is this person on trial for murder? What happened? But then I also want to find out: are there any lessons that we can learn as a society so that we can do better, so that we don't have someone that's like the Regina Johnson case that I won the contest on, that we don't have a 14-year-old daughter dead on the floor. So I think that there's always that lesson, or the haunting questions. Could somebody have intervened sooner? What could we have done?
So tell us a little bit about that case. So for the listeners, they won't know anything. So let's start with some of the basic elements of the case.
Okay, so Regina Johnson was on trial for the murder of her husband, Reuben, and her daughter, Aaliyah. And Aaliyah was a 14-year-old, this well-loved cheerleader, just very vivacious, vibrant person. And they were both found in their home, shot in the head. So, I mean, it was a horrible, horrible case. So the prosecution said that Regina had ambushed and executed her husband and the daughter, and then just left them to rot for 3 days while she thought about how to get rid of them, because she stayed with the bodies and even testified at the trial that she laid down next to her daughter's body for 3 days and didn't contact the police. So I think that was one of the reasons people were somewhat attracted to the case, was like, well, wow, that's grisly facts. Like, well, what happened? And so, you wanted to know exactly what happened in that house. And the defense said, no, Regina did shoot her husband, but only after he killed her daughter during this really violent family argument. And so the jury really had to determine, you know, what really happened and who was telling the truth, and look at the forensics and just all the evidence and come to a conclusion or a decision. And then, so basically, in the end, the jury found that Regina was guilty, and they found her guilty of second-degree murder for both Aaliyah and Reuben. And so there was just so many things that had happened in this case, though, because Regina had testified, and so compellingly, too, just crying and just how much she had really, really loved Aaliyah, and that there was just no way that she could ever have killed her daughter, that her love for her and her defense attorney, who actually was my friend, who's been my friend for 20 years, he's with the public defender's office, and his arguments were, if there was a love that, you know, mother, well, every mother loves her child, right? But this love, if there is, was even higher, was greater, the deepest possible love that could ever exist, and she would never, ever, ever have harmed her daughter. But all the forensic evidence showed that she did. And the question was, why? And so you had to get into these different issues as to what happened. And the thing is that Regina did have some mental health issues. And, I mean, nobody ever came out and said, Regina Johnson is mentally insane, and that's why she committed this crime. But they did bring out evidence that she had at one point some paranoia, that she believed that her office was being bugged, she believed people were following her, she believed that Reuben was poisoning her food and drink, and then they had the evidence from different doctors that she was suffering from great depression, because she had been laid off her job of 18 years, and she was an office administrator, and she was laid off, and she felt like she had lost her identity, and now Aaliyah is 14 and it's not needing her as much. So she's starting to feel that she's losing all these things in her life. And so that's what the prosecution said was one of the reasons why she just, that she was losing all these people in her life, and she kind of just, I guess, just kind of lost it and killed her husband and her daughter. And then some testimony came in that, well, they tried to raise, the prosecution raised that she really had wanted her husband dead, that she had all this anger towards him because over their 20-year marriage, he had had all these, you know, he had been this constant philanderer and had all these different affairs. And so the defense said, yes, he had all these affairs, but his unfaithfulness had been so constant during the marriage that after a time, she just became indifferent. And the marriage was old, it was cold, it was stale, it had been over 3 years, and they were only staying together for Aaliyah. So they just said they were living separate lives, so this really wasn't a motive for that. And the defense said there really wasn't a motive in this case. And that's the big question in this case, is that there was no motive. There wasn't any motive for her to kill her husband. There wasn't any motive for her to kill her daughter, so why would she do it? And I think that this case takes us to issues about mental health, because you wonder, did Regina commit these murders in the throes of mental illness or during some type of paranoid delusion? Or there was all this other evidence also that was brought in that she was on all these antidepressants. Was it the antidepressants, all this medication that made her, you know, suicidal or homicidal and made her commit these crimes? Because I don't think anybody watching that trial or being in that courtroom could doubt that she did really love her daughter, and that she did have this great love, but that she did kill her, and you have this 14-year-old daughter who's dead on the floor. So it was a horrible case. The judge who's presided over tons and tons of cases for over 25 years said that this is one of the most tragic cases we are likely to see, and that she couldn't remember a time when she would look over into the jury box and there would be multiple jurors crying over the testimony. So, I mean, it was a really tough case. And it brings into question, like I said, the mental illness and what could have been done.
Well, Aleda, listening to what you said, that's the logical conclusion. Because like you said, even if the marriage was old, cold, dead, you know, there was no more affection between them. I mean, in today's society, that is so cliche. You know,
right.
a lot of marriages, you know, suffer their ups and downs. But that doesn't lead anybody to murder their child.
Right.
So were there any other clues leading towards a defense of, you know, not guilty by reason of mental defect, other than what you just said? I mean, were there counseling records? Were there forensic psychologists, you know, testifying? I mean, what led them to this, you know, to this type of defense?
Well, their defense was she didn't do it because she loved her too much, and they discounted a lot of the evidence. But, I mean, they really couldn't go to a mental insanity defense, because they would have to show that she didn't understand the nature and quality of her criminal act, or that she couldn't distinguish between right and wrong. And the thing here is the prosecutor would bring up that, well, she did understand what she was doing was wrong. She did know what was the difference between right and wrong, because she tried to cover up her crime. She never called the police. She stayed in the house with you know, her husband and her daughter, who was dead for 3 days. She lay down next to her body. She disposed of some bullets that she flushed down the toilet. And so basically the prosecution would say, hey, she disposed of evidence. She had a consciousness of guilt, and she knew what she was doing was wrong. So my friend Neil Bessie, who was the public defender on the case, I mean, he couldn't really raise the mental insanity defense, because there were these, you know, these steps that she took afterwards to show that maybe she really wasn't that out of it, because she tried to cover up her crime. But I mean, I think that's the hard part of this case, is that it seemed like she was doing really well. She had this job for 18 years as a office administrator, and they brought in testimony of people who were her boss, who said she was doing a great job, and the clients that loved her. And so it seemed like she just had these different episodes that came up, and that the question is, who could have intervened? I mean, according to the prosecution, her husband did try to help her, but One of the things that I saw in the case was that their daughter Aaliyah had missed 65 tardies or absences at her school, and so that to me was like, wow, well, they didn't break it down as to what was the tardies and what was the actual absences. But if you were missing school that much or being late that much, it seems like the school should be calling and saying, what's going on in this house that this child is not getting to school on time? Because I know when my son misses school, the school calls me right away. Why isn't he here? So it seemed like
they do now.
Maybe they could have gone in there and seen what was happening. But they did have people that said that friends that tried to help her, that were taking Aaliyah to school or taking Aaliyah different places because Regina wasn't able to. So it seemed like people were trying to help, but maybe didn't understand the extent of the problem. And then you also have, of course, the issue of you have a loaded gun in a house because Reuben was had been in the military. And then once he got out, he worked as a security guard. And so one of his jobs required him to have a gun. So he has this gun out, but it's not locked away. So that was one of the questions I had, was like, well, why are you having a loaded gun that's not locked away in the house when someone's battling depression and having these paranoid episodes? So, I mean, and that goes, you know, that gets into all the gun issues. But that was kind of an issue that was raised in my mind. Well, but, you know, Reuben paid for that with his life, right? So.
Yes. Oh boy, that's a whole nother genie. We're not going to let out of that bottle.
Right. I mean, that's a real hot topic now.
But if I didn't know better, I would swear that you were here in Huntsville, Alabama, because we had a case that was very, very similar, the Natasha Ward case. And this was a mother who had starved her three children to death and locked them in a closet and then walked away. And the defense was, well, she's not guilty by mental defect, because what mother in her right mind would sit there and watch her three children starve to death, not call 911, not go outside her front door and flag down a police officer or go to a neighbor? Much like your case, she was very, very silent. And Aleda, I'm just not buying that.
You know, buying the fact of, I think
no,
that Regina...
not at all. I'm not buying the fact that mental illness would lead you to allow your child to die or be complicit in their death.
Well, and see, I guess that's the haunting question of the case then. So then why did they die? Why did Aaliyah, 14 years old, why was she shot in the back of her head? And that's the question we don't know. Why did she kill her daughter then? Because from the testimony of friends and neighbors and relatives, this was a mother who was very involved with her daughter's life, someone that she really loved Aaliyah. She helped her with her schoolwork. She took her on vacation. She took her shopping for clothes. They did all this stuff together. Then why, if it wasn't for the mental issues that she was dealing with, why would she kill her? And and the defense, even to this day, the defense, after the verdict came in, said that they will always have doubts. For having worked on the case for years, have doubts as to whether if she really did kill her. Even though the jury said that she did, that the evidence says leads you to believe that she did kill these two people, they will always have doubts of whether she really did.
Oh, yeah. There's never going to be any doubt that either one of these mothers killed their children, because all the prosecutor has to do is point over in a corner at the dead body. But can I put forth a theory?
Sure.
Much like our case, maybe in the case that you wrote about, maybe the mother killed the child in an effort to rekindle the romance in the marriage. Because in our case, it was put forth that she wanted to get back together with the children's father. And he's like, I don't want children. So, by all logic, let's get rid of the children, and that will heal this relationship.
And then they can get back together.
Exactly.
Right.
What did you discover in your research? Maybe some potential theories as to why this happened.
Well, I don't think, in this case, I don't think that she did want to get back together with Ruben. I think that that marriage has kind of run its course. I just think that, you know, I think that it was the mental issues that she was dealing with that caused her to have this mental break, if you will, and end up, I mean, because she was saying she's having this paranoia. She's believing her office is bugged. She's believing people are following her. She's believing that Ruben's poisoning her food or her drink. So it's like, I think that she is having some type of paranoia. And so, I mean, the story that she told was that she had, that there was, there's kind of an echo right now for a second.
Yes, so I hear it as well.
Okay, let me move back for a second. So basically what she had testified was that on the morning of the shooting, she had told Ruben that she was going to take Aaliyah late to school as Aaliyah was tired, and that Ruben was angry about this because Aaliyah had missed school so much. And, you know, and then that's when the school record came in of her having 55 times where she had been absent or tardy in an 8-month period. And so then Ruben was blaming Aaliyah's boyfriend for keeping her up late on the telephone. And when Ruben returned from his doctor's appointment that morning and he found Aaliyah and Regina still home, an argument began. And he started yelling at Aaliyah about her boyfriend and telling her that she would end up like his older daughter who had gotten pregnant in high school. And if that happened, he would have nothing to do with her. So, and Regina said this was harsh words that he had said in the past. This was like kind of a constant argument. And finally Aaliyah ran sobbing from the room and said, ran downstairs and came back with Ruben's gun, said, I'm tired of you yelling at me. I'm tired of you accusing me. I'm tired of you not believing me. And then she was holding the gun on Ruben. He knocked it out of her hands, and then he shoots her. And then Regina cries out, what have you done? You've shot my baby girl. And that's when she picks up the gun, and she shoots Ruben. So that's you know, basically that's what she said. And then they brought in, the prosecutor brought in all this evidence that showed that Regina's fingerprints were actually on the gun magazine, which evidenced she had loaded the gun in advance, that this was not a spontaneous act. It was not a gun that she grabbed in the midst of this terrible fight, that her fingerprints were already there, so she had already planned, that she had already planned to kill Ruben because she was angry about these affairs and she was just had enough. And so, the prosecution also brought in that Aaliyah had this open jar of Vaseline, and she was walking with it down the hall because that day it had been picture day. She had gotten out of the shower, and she's walking down the hall with this towel wrapped around her and this open jar of Vaseline. And then she's shot from behind, and her body falls forward. And so the prosecutor said that there was no way that she was in this terrible argument with her father and holding the gun on Ruben, because she's basically walking down the hall with this Vaseline, this open jar of Vaseline in her hand, and she's shot from behind. She didn't even know what was coming. She was ambushed and executed, and she fell forward, and the Vaseline jar fell forward, and it was splattered with blood on all sides. So the prosecutor said that's the most damning piece of evidence in this case to show that what Regina testified to is not true. And so after that, then Regina lays down with her body and stays there for 3 days and doesn't call the police. And it's not till family is constantly calling, that finally she picks up the phone and talks to her sister, and then the authorities are finally alerted. But she does write this note in red lipstick on the mirror. And so, I mean, she said she was under the care of a doctor and was taking these antidepressants. So she writes a note to her doctor that said, Dr. Chen, you knew I should not have been taking all that meds. This is your fault. You told Ruben to give it to me anyways, 5 pills. So in this red lipstick, she's blaming her doctor. And the prosecutor is saying that this is somewhat of a confession. She's telling us what happened, and she's blaming her doctor. And was she going to kill herself? That was what the prosecutor asked. What, you know, maybe she was writing this final note and then had planned to take her own life, but then somehow along the way changed her mind and came up with this story. So that was like, there was a lot of evidence for the jury to have to go through and to think about, like, what really happened? What happened in that house?
When you're involved in these stories, does it, and you write about them, how does it affect you on the next case that's similar that you're going to do?
Well, you know what? I try to just really listen. When I'm in the courtroom, I try to listen and just judge each case from the facts that I've heard. So I mean, it does affect you in the sense that I think with this, that there was like, for me, being in that courtroom, there was just terrible sadness in this case, just with the pain of a 14-year-old daughter dying in the way she did, the pain of Reuben, who was 56, dying, and he had children from a previous marriage that were grown, and they came and testified and seen them on the stand crying about the day they found out that their father had died. And, you know, I don't think that it you can just walk away from the really the agony that is present in a lot of these trials and not have it affect you. But when I try to write a story, I'm trying to write from what the jury heard in that specific case and what lessons we can learn from that case, if there's anything that we can do better. So I think in this case, I guess my question was, well, why wasn't the school coming and contacting and saying, what's going on in that house? You have a child missing school 65 times or being tardy so many times. And you have friends that were seeing somebody's mental health going down. And you wonder, could something have been done?
Yeah.
And that's the question. Could have been done.
Yeah. What do you plan on doing now with your writing career? Like, are you planning on doing books or kind of getting involved in that or continue to write articles?
Well, I'm writing articles, and I would love to write a book. I'm contemplating writing a book about some of the compelling trials that I've gone to in San Diego, and then maybe working with a forensic psychiatrist. One of my good friends is a forensic psychiatrist, and try to answer some of these questions that are raised or come up with some type of solution. And addressing from his point, the mental health aspect of these cases. And so that's what I thought about. And right now I'm writing articles. I write stories for, well, actually Judith is so kind. She just asked me to write for True Crime Case Files. And then I'm going to be writing stories for San Diego Lawyer Magazine. And then I do a blog also for Psychology Today. But that's not true crime stories. That's more motivational and, you know, uplifting type human interest stories. So I'm going to keep writing. And another case that I just went to that I think was also unbelievably compelling was this attempted murder case with Diana Lovejoy and Weldon McDavid. And I wrote a story about that called When Divorce is Not Enough, the Diana Lovejoy and Weldon McDavid Attempted Murder Trial. And that case had a lot of really interesting facts and even sometimes salacious facts. And then it also had haunting questions and lessons, I think, that can be learned. So if we have time, I'd love to talk about that case.
Yeah, sure. Give us a little briefing on that. Kind of what do you find real interesting about that case?
Well, the Diane Lovejoy case was a case where the question was, did she hire a gunman to come and kill her estranged husband? And so what happened was that Diane Lovejoy was in a contentious divorce and bitter custody battle with her ex, Greg Mulvihill. And so she'd been in this divorce for over 2 years. And according to the prosecution, she did not want to share their child with her husband, and she didn't want to have to pay him any money in this divorce. And so because of that, because of those two reasons, she decided to have him killed. And the defense said, no, there was never a plan to kill Greg Mulvihill. The two, Weldon McDavid and Diana, were both just trying to gather evidence against him that could be used in the family court in a custody matter. So they came up with this plan. It was a stupid plan, but it wasn't a plan to kill. So basically what happened is that Weldon McDavid is this Marine of 12 years and this gun instructor of 18 years. He's like this expert in marksmanship and weaponry. And so what happens is they decide that they're going to have him call Greg Mulvihill late at night, like almost 11 o'clock at night, and he tells him that he's a criminal investigator, that's hired by his ex-wife, Diana, and that he has documents that he's going to want to see, which are evidence of him abusing his son, which his ex-wife is going to use against him in court, and that he's going to really want to see this evidence and that he needs to come out now to see this evidence. But they didn't really have any evidence. But they figured that if someone would come out late at night to this isolated spot, it would prove that he was guilty, because why would an innocent person come? And they were going to videotape him and somehow present this to the family court. So they call Greg Mulvihill, and they tell him to come to this dirt path in this kind of like isolated area, and they're going to tape a package to a power pole. And so Greg decides to go, and he ends up calling his friend, and they go at like after 11 o'clock at night to this isolated spot. They get there. There's no package there. And then they look over in some bushes, and they see that there's this guy laying in a sniper position with this barrel of gun pointed at him. So then at that point, Greg Mulvihill is shot under his left armpit. And he had been holding this light. They called it a flashlight, but it's more like a little bicycle, a bicycle light. And he had been scanning the area because it was so dark. So his arm, his left arm is up. He's hit under his left armpit. And he ends up running back to his car, and they end up calling 911, and they get him to the hospital, and he survives it. And he becomes this star witness of the trial. But, I mean, it gets into all this stuff about, was there really abuse going on? Because Diana was saying that Greg Mulvihill had been abusing their son, and so that's why she had gone to the family court to try to get all these different orders, and she was simply trying to get more evidence against him. I mean, it was kind of a, maybe what the attorney said, a stupid plan. And you had to, the jury had to determine, did this really happen, or did they really want to kill him? And of course, what comes into the trial is that Diana Lovejoy and Weldon McDavid are actually having this sexual relationship. And Weldon McDavid is married. His wife is actually pregnant at the time. So, you know, you get into that. And then you get into the fact that they had some crazy evidence that came up. They have one of the ways they tracked it back to Weldon McDavid was that the officers found at the shooting location, they found this towel that had this feces on it, which, you know, this ended up kind of being gross, but at the same time kind of provided some humor in the trial, because the DNA is now traced back to Weldon McDavid. And so prior to that, he had said, I don't know anything about this shooting. I've never been to that area. But then when they confront him with the towel and say, well, then why is your DNA on this towel? He could no longer deny it. And then they actually bring, they had pictures of this towel with a deposit on it, and they bring it out into court, and they put it on the big overhead screen. So everybody's looking at it. They bring the towel out and hold up the towel for the jury. So, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, a little bit shocking. And then
or shameful.
Yeah, it's both, right? So then McDavid, testified at trial. Diana Lovejoy did not. But when Weldon McDavid took the stand, he was, you know, he was embarrassed by it. He was embarrassed, he was annoyed by it, and he apologized that people had to actually see that. And then, you know, there was all these question after question about the reason why he had to go to the bathroom here. And the prosecution was trying to say, you were really nervous, that's why you knew you were going to try to shoot somebody and kill somebody, that's why this happened. And he's saying, no, I'm this Marine that was so trained at night and in sniper school that I would never get nervous, and it was just spicy Mexican food. And so some of it was funny because you had reporters, I mean, and they had datelines in there taping this. So you had them close up on the, you know, the pictures of the photos of this towel with the, you know, with the feces on it, and then all the questions, and people were trying not to laugh, and even Diana Lovejoy at times laughed about it. So, I mean, that did provide some humor, but it was...
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a pretty crappy thing to do, but...
What do you think about that, being having all the cameras in the courtroom? I mean, you deal with that as an attorney, and you see it on TV. You know, I always ask people their opinion because they're in the business, so we call it. But what do you think of having Dateline in on something that you're trying, or having just cameras and people all around? You know, I mean, doesn't it affect the way you do your job?
No, I think it does. I think it really, some attorneys say it doesn't at all. You know, it doesn't. They're here to, like, the prosecutor in this case was, no, I'm here to get justice for this family, and that's what I'm focused on. I'm not focused on the camera. I'm focused on the evidence, and I'm focused on justice. But I think that it does have to have, I would think, have some type of effect on how you behave, because you've got, with this case, with Weldon McDavid and Diane Lovejoy, they had, like, at one time, I think there was, like, 7 cameras. I mean, you couldn't even sit on one side of the courtroom because you couldn't see past the cameras. So, you know, I don't know. I think that's a tough issue because you're dealing with people that are in the worst time of their life. And, like, for instance, here, Diana Lovejoy's mom and sister came every day to the trial, and they were in great emotional anguish. So, and also Weldon McDavid's family and Greg Mulvihill's family. I mean, you have all these families that are in agony, and you're, like, filming every little minute of them. So, I don't know. I think it's so hard.
People like Kevin, you know, the media, he'll be out there calling everybody names. Like, he's out, you know, he's talking about your hair or what you're wearing and what shoes you have on, and
exactly. And but, I mean, because most people don't know how to accessorize.
Well, but isn't that going to, that's going to affect you? You know what I'm saying? Like, cause we've talked to people that, you know, were attorneys or defense attorneys for popular cases that became, you know, like a zoo, and people are talking about their weight and their tie and their hair. And I just don't know how you could go about your job normally when everywhere you turn they're talking about you, and not in a good way.
Right. Well, I think it'd be very stressful. I mean, you have, of course, like the OJ trial. You have with the Marcia Clark, they're talking about her hair. They're talking about the photos that were taken of her in Greece with her, you know, topless or whatever. So I think that that's, no, I think it's hard from every area. I think that a lot of people would, a lot of the families probably would not want the cameras in there. And I know in this case, the defense attorneys didn't talk to the media after the verdict and, you know, throughout the case. Sometimes they do. All attorneys do talk to the media, but in this case they didn't. You know, it's a hard case.
It's a tough.
Like, I just went to it's a tough call because I just went to I'm going to a case right now that's going on here in San Diego. It's a murder case. It's a stepfather who's accused of killing this little boy who's 2 years old. He's claiming the child disappeared at a park. And the thing is, the little boy has never been found. So his body has never been found. And so was he killed? and thrown away in the trash, as the prosecution says, or was he abducted at this park? So with that case, the mother came and testified, and this is a cold case. I mean, the stepfather wasn't even charged for 14 years. So, you know, like 16 years have gone by, and the mother was on the stand this past week, and the judge had ordered the media to title her face, and then somehow it didn't happen, and so she and her face ended up being broadcast to the news, and she was really upset because she didn't want her face being broadcast on the news when she's crying about her child that, you know, is her child dead or is her child missing? I mean, was the child abducted? So, I mean, it's a horrible.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a horrible question either way. Yeah,
it's terrible to do that. Who do you have for writing influences, or do you have any?
You know, the person that I really loved reading was, is Ann Rule. That's who I used to read a lot. I read her, story on Ted Bundy, The Stranger Beside Me, because she had worked with Ted Bundy and then found out all these that he had been the person that who had committed all these terrible killings. So I read her stories, I think, for years. Yeah. And then I also read Caitlin Rother and those two people, I think, are the main people that I've been reading.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, that's good to
know.
And I'm amazed at
their research, because my stories for Anne have been more about what's happened actually inside that courtroom. So I'm basically telling you, if you didn't get to go to the trial, this is what happened. Let me take you inside the courtroom and I will tell you, like, you have a front row seat. I'll tell you what happened. And I think a lot of the other books, like Caitlin Rother and Ann Rule, they did so many interviews with the family, and they did a lot of their own investigative research. And I think that's amazing, and very time consuming too. But I think that it adds so much to the book to be able to give that kind of background.
Yeah. I hear Al Warren's really good too. Listen. let's talk about, how do people get a hold of you? How do they find your website, your writings, and everything? Give out your details.
Oh, okay. My website is www.aleidalaw.com.
Well, fantastic.
And
yep.
Yes. And everything's on there. You have how to contact me and phone numbers, everything. So.
And we have that linked, of course, to our website as well. Thank you very much for taking the time, and congratulations on your win on the True Crime Case Files contest. And we'll look for your next article. And thanks.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course.
You're going to be a regular.
I really appreciate it. Well, yes, that's exciting. I'm excited about that.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.